Now, Lou, you were saying you got the check, but did it bounce?
I went later. I went back up to Nashville and talked to Governor Clement. I never felt unkindly toward him. When you think of it, here was a governor leaving office, about to give a check for $100,000 to a known campaign supporter. It just didn't look good. Yet there was nothing in the world wrong with it, see what I mean? But from Clement's standpoint, you could see that he represented the people of the state by stopping it until he knew more about it, see? So I went back, as I say, and went and talked to him, and he said, "Lou, if you can show me where this project would have statewide interest or more than a local interest, we'll give it every consideration." And of course, we undertook to do that. I say we, Jim Nichols of the Chamber of Commerce and so on, went up and talked to him, and but we never were able to move him. But it was really a Browning project.
You were in line also with your interest in conservation and outdoors. You were president and a longtime leader of the Audubon Society here. And it undertook, I know, a number of projects during your activity, period of activity. Tell us something about it.
Well, I got interested in the society a few months after it had been formed at Mrs. Sarah Keith Patton's home on Walden's Ridge, topside, along about 1940, as the Robert Sparks Walker Audubon Society.
Excuse me, just a half minute. Let's identify Robert Sparks Walker very briefly, so we'll.
Well, Robert Sparks Walker was, first place, was the most unselfish man I ever knew. And he was self-educated in his conservation activities, identifying animals and insects and birds and so forth, as well as plants. And he wrote next to the Nature column for the Chattanooga Times for I don't know how long, many, many years on Sunday.
30 or 40 years.
Yeah, a long time. And then, of course, he, back in the days of the old local magazine of the paper, you know.
Yes.
He wrote regularly for that on subjects of conservation. And, of course, he had a national audience through one of the Nature magazines that had a national circulation. So he wanted this old home place out here at East Brainerd, where he was born and raised, he wanted to set that up as a sanctuary. He had four or five brothers and sisters. He gave his interest, this was after the association was formed, shortly after, and he gave his interest in the property and talked his brothers and sisters into accumulating together, contributing together $6,000 when I think at that time the property was appraised at $18,000, and he got Mr. Chapin Sr., who was a very good friend of his, to underwrite the cost of it. And it took him 2 years of constant nagging at the board of directors to get the name changed. He wanted it to be the Chattanooga Audubon Society and not Robert Sparks Walker. So finally, the board went along with him and changed the name.
Name of the Audubon Society.
Chattanooga Audubon Society. And then we named the property after Mrs. Elise Chapin, out of respect and appreciation to Mr. Chapin for that gift.
Say what that home site was out there, what the historical...
It has a very rich history in Cherokee Indian history. Sparks Walker tells of how John Sevier came on and crossed the creek on horseback and went over to Little Owl's village and tore it up. And his father, Robert Sparks Walker's father, helped build a railroad that ran through the property. I think it was the Western and an Atlantic, I believe that was it. And then, of course, the old general went by there almost daily, and the Texas and some of the other old locomotives. And I think the Andrews Raiders were finally, most of them were finally apprehended.
In that general neighborhood.
And I think they're buried in the National Cemetery over here.
Yes, they are.
Then, of course, the property was added to from time to time and started out with 105 acres. And I guess maybe the sanctuary itself now is about 130 or 140 acres. And then, of course, we were given the property at Fuller Ridge when Claude Fuller died, and of course we had a hand in his leaving his gun collection to the Chickamauga Chattanooga National Military Park here. He was on our board, and of course I worked with the Rossville Kiwanis Club, we wanted to get $100,000 to build an administrative building, an addition to the administrative building to house these guns. And the bill had to originate in Georgia, So we got the Rossville Club, and then I wrote Keith Offer and so on, and other members of the Congress to appropriate this money during Truman's administration. And we finally got it, and then Claude left the property up there to us with a second beneficiary, in case we didn't stay in business, was the YMCA, to be used as a day camp. And Ed Chapin was on the junior. Ed Chapin Jr. was on the our board, and also on the board of the YMCA. And after about a couple of years of ownership, it became a financial burden to us, and so on. So we told Ed that we would give our rights over to the YMCA because it was the second choice of Mr. Fuller. But we thought that they ought to reimburse us for the money that we'd spent on it, about $3,500, see. So they agreed to do it, and that was a blessing to us, of course, and we got out from under what was quite a burden.
Yeah.
Then, of course, the next thing that we got from for the society was the McClellan Island, I was president in Mr. McClellan's office. That's Mr. R.J. McClellan.
Yes.
When he gave us the deed to it. And he also gave us a check for $700, which he thought we could use to clear the place. And in 2 days, he was dead. We hadn't even used the check. And we couldn't use the check legally. So, when we went to Mr. Chapin about it, he said he knew thoroughly what Mr. McClellan's intentions were, that Mr. McClellan had bought a slight interest that he, Chapin, had, so that he could give this clear to the Audubon Society. So Ed said, under those circumstances, you go ahead and use the check and I'll see that it clears, which he did, see. Now, I don't suppose he violated any law, but he probably violated a banking rule. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to change it, you see. But anyway, we gave that was the first step in the island, and of course I've been chairman of the island committee ever since then.
Yes.
And we are trying to develop it, and we take people over there now through the spring, summer, and fall months on weekends at no cost, except that they pay, I think, $2 to Hoseman, who succeeded Gladish down on the river, you know.
Yes.
And he takes these groups over, makes about 3 round trips, about one every hour, see, to show people the island and so on and so on.
Has the society come to peace of mind about the bridge, the new bridge?
Oh yeah, they never have been, they were never enthusiastically for the bridge going across the island.
Yes.
But they said in a resolution by the board that they would not oppose it.
I see.
Now, some of the officers of the society, and in one case a president, did try to oppose it.
Yes.
And that didn't leave the Audubon image what we wanted it to be, you see. But we've never really opposed it. Now, although Carl Gibson, who was president, most recently, until our friend up at Covenant College took over in the last month or so, was trying to get some of the things from the state in exchange for the right-of-way that would be beneficial to the society. Maybe a stairway down from the middle of the bridge, some of the utilities, like water, like power, gas, mm-hmm. And so forth, see? And they were talking in terms of $100,000, but really, I don't think we're entitled to much more than what the actual cost to the society would be. Because after all, we are citizens, we want the bridge, too, you know what I mean? And since there's been such a controversy over it, which lasted so long, we as citizens, not as members of the society, really, want to see the bridge built, you see?
There's one more thing I'd like to ask you, Lou, unless I've worn you out.
No.
You've been you were for so many years a member and a leader in Kiwanis Club, which is a major organization in this town. What is your, just as an overall view, what is your view of the civic club's role in the community?
Well, I think it's just about the only excuse a city club has of being in existence is trying to improve their community. And the Kiwanis Club has a singular reputation for anything anybody wanted done back in the early days, in the 1918, 1920, along in there, they took it to the Kiwanis Club. And if the Kiwanis Club didn't pass it, it just died. That's in short about what happens. So I have a strong feeling that a civic club has a very definite place in the development of a community. So long as they don't compete with each other. If they each have their particular niche in the community's activities and so on, I think it's they do a terrific job.
Just name a few of the major projects that the Kiwanis Club is, over the years has headed up and seen through.
Well, of course, the first project was the Memorial Auditorium, which was to be built to serve a useful purpose in the community. And to honor the people, the boys that were that gave their lives in the war.
World War I. This was, as I recall, in maybe 1920 and 22 and 23.
Long in 20 by 24, somewhere along in there.
Okay.
And they got the cooperation of the Rotary Club and the Civitan Club is one of the old clubs here, you know, and so on, and in bringing this about. They had to, of course, get a law bill through the legislature and the city government, the county government, and so on and so on. And that was their first project. And now, of course, they had a hand in a lot of others. They started the local market, you know, where the farmers come in and brought their produce. Farmers market, yeah. They started that. Those are two things that I can recall and remember. Of course, my book, Kiwanis 88, gives a whole story of the activities of the Kiwanis Club. Incidentally, the 88 part of that name was that we were the 88th club in Kiwanis International. And I think now there's some 5,000 or 6,000 clubs.
I think so, yes. It They have been active in, I know, in the organization of the Boys Club and the Girls Home, Opportunity Home.
That's right.
Number of projects of that type. You were president, and also the recipient of the Distinguished Service Award.
That's right. I was, of course, flabbergasted with that. Maybe I shouldn't say this, I don't know, but I knew the chairman of the Service Award Committee for that year. And I had nominated the Siskin brothers. And I said, I know I'm talking out of turn. I know I've got no business doing this. But I think they so far ahead of me in their contributions to this community that I hope they get the award. I had already told him that I heard that I was being considered. And they gave it to Siskin, which pleased me, really, no end. And I got it the next year.
Due recognition comes along, Lou.
I guess so. I just can't believe that I'm entitled or that I have earned what the people of Chattanooga and the state of Tennessee in Hamilton County has showered on me. I just can't believe that anybody could earn that much recognition.
Well, I think other people feel differently. You've lived a long and useful and a productive life. Matter of fact, you're about to come up on your 91st birthday, right?
Won't be long.
June the 6th?
June the 24th.
June 24th.
It's interesting that that on that date I will have lived here for 50 years, which I've already said.
Yes.
Now there's 41 other years, and they were divided up twice in Kansas City, twice in Birmingham, and then in Springfield, Missouri, Jackson, Mississippi, Shreveport, Louisiana, and for a short time, Dallas, Texas.
You lived a full life before you ever got around to Chattanooga.
So I really feel like I'm a native.
Well, of course you are. The only other thing that I even recall is your service as a grand jury foreman for a couple of years. I believe that's a two-year term.
Two-year term, and I served a year and a half. In other words, I served 1 year of the second term.
Yes.
You don't talk much about what happens in a grand jury room, but I do want to. Since you brought it up to mention this, I had about 6 grand juries during this term, and when I had the first orientation meeting of each of these grand juries. And in many cases, there was at least one lady, or sometime maybe two or three, or even more, as members. I told them that that they were going to learn how the other half the world lives, and would get down on their knees at night thanking the Lord for the privilege of living in our half. But anyway, on the second day of one of these new grand juries, one of the ladies said, "Mr. Williams, you know everybody up at City Hall, don't you?" I said, "Well, nearly everybody." I said, "What's your trouble?" She said, "I got a traffic ticket." And I said, "What was the offense?" She said, "I was on Market Street and in a arrow turn lane, and I didn't want to turn. And when I stopped, everybody behind me started blowing at me, and that attracted a police officer. And he came over and he gave me a ticket." "Well," I said, "after we get through here this afternoon, we'll walk down to City Hall." That's all I said. So I asked her, on the way down, I asked her for the ticket, see? She gave it to me. So I walked in. I didn't go to see the judge or anything like that. I walked in where you pay off your tickets, see? So I said to this young fellow, we are on the grand jury and we are not looking for any favors. How much is this ticket?" He looked at it, said, 8 1/4. So I gave him $10 and he gave me the change. And I turned to her. She was, I could just tell, so mad that she couldn't hardly speak, see? I said, "That's the only way I know of how to fix a ticket for a member of the grand jury." See? Now, we parted. Now I said, "Anytime, next Tuesday, next month, next year, or never, you feel like reimbursing me, I'd be glad to have it," see? The next Tuesday I walked in, walked up to the big table where I sat. There was an envelope there, and I opened it. And there was the 8 1/4, and one of the nicest letters I ever got from anybody. She said she really apologized for wanting to fix a ticket when we were indicting people for the same sort of thing, you know what I mean? And it pleased me very much, and it pleased her. It made a Christian out of her, too, as far as that sort of thing is concerned, see? I'd like maybe to mention one thing that I think we both overlooked, or maybe you didn't even know about. During Governor Browning's term of, as governor, I mean, 1949, he had been elected but had not yet been nominated, I mean inaugurated. And my wife and I were just driving back from a trip we'd made up to Aurora, Illinois, where we went up to see our son and his family. And coming back through a little part of Indiana and all through the state of Kentucky and part of the state of Illinois, I noticed these roadside tables. Some of them were very elaborate. I mean, rest facilities and all of that. Some of them were just tables. So I figured, well, now I'm gonna recommend that to Governor Browning. So I did. And the day after he was inaugurated, He sent a highway department man who was in charge of highway beautification down here, and I got the Chamber of Commerce Committee, which I was representing. And Mrs. George West was one I remember. And we took this visitor down to Halesbar Dam. And there we selected the site for two of these tables. Three or four years later, or maybe 4 or 5 years later, I wanted to get the specifications and the plans for the table, so, because I thought maybe we could use them out at the Audubon Sanctuary, see? Yeah. So I wrote him and I said, incidentally, how many of these tables are in existence now in Tennessee? He flabbergasted me by saying 700. And he said there's 200 or 300 more on the list to be investigated and so on. See?
That is great.
So I thought that that was something that we as members of the Chamber Committee could really be proud of.
Well, the rest areas, that type of thing is a marvelous development now on the interstate system.
Oh,
began,
yeah.
Began right there.
That's right.
In Tennessee. Well, Lou, it's been a wonderful experience talking to you.
Well, it's been an experience for me. I've relived a lot of things here today.
Sometimes you forget what you do know,
that's
what
right.
You have known.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much, and I appreciate it on behalf of the library and the Oral History Project.
Fine. Since you mentioned the library, I just finished genealogy on my wife's family. 757 pages, and over a 10 or 12 year period of research in which I visited about 8 states, 3 of them twice, and probably a dozen libraries, like 2 in Atlanta, 3 in Columbus, Ohio, New Orleans, and a number of others. I got, for the first 2 years, most of my research material came from our library.
Is that right?
And I've said this to Ms. Arnold and to Clara Swan and Judy Quito and some of the rest of them, that none of these libraries that I visited could hold a candle to what we had in our genealogical department of our library. Now I said, I don't know anything about the rest of the library. I'm sure it's just as good in those departments. But I can say this, that I can certainly take my hat off to the genealogical department of this library, and I'm proud of it, see?
They're doing a fine job, and the Oral History Project is just another step to adding to that general level of activity.
I'm not going to be very popular, I don't think, with the staff down there at the library, because I'm about to unload on them all of the material that I've collected, which is the basis for this book I just mentioned. That is the contents of a 4-drawer commercial letter file. But it will be, you see, primarily it's Xerox copies of death records, marriage records, deeds of property, both seller and buyer and all of that. Then I collected probably at a cost of $3,000 or $4,000, because in most cases you pay a dollar a page for them. See, and but I'm going to give all of that material to our library, and it will be. It really will be the national headquarters for searching the family of Harbour. And that's H-A-R-B-O-U-R.
H-A-R-B-O-U-R.
Yeah. And it's also spelled H-A-R-B-E-R. Yes. H-A-R-B-E-R-T. Mm-hmm. One that I like to tell about, two brothers that settled in Sangamon County, Illinois, which is Springfield. One of them named Samuel, the other one named Levi or Levi. Samuel spelt the name H-A-R-B-O-U-R. No question about them being brothers. Levi spelt his name H-A-R-B-U-R. And the only one. I have all kinds of H-A-R-B-O-R-B-U, you know, but that's the only one that was spelled B-U-R, see?
It's marvelous to me that we can trace any of our lineage back, you know, with this sort of thing happening.
I can tell some wonderful stories about this genealogy. I knew from my wife's meager records, and she didn't go outside the family. She was just inquiring of her elderly aunts about her ancestry. See, she didn't go to a library to dig it up that way. So all I knew was that she started with Elijah, whose son David was a traveling minister, Baptist, primitive Baptist minister, who lived and died on his farm in the Blue Ridge Mountains of West Virginia. And there ain't no such mountains in West Virginia. They're in Virginia, you see.
Yeah.
But this was back before there was a West Virginia.
Yeah.
And whoever wrote it that way said Western Virginia, you see what I mean? So I had, in the first place, there were large families. In the second place, all families, almost without exception, named their children after biblical characters, see? I don't know how many Johns and Davids and Joshuas and
Levi.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. And Samuel. So, I had four early Virginia David Harbors. No juniors, no middle names, see? But I knew that one of them was my wife's ancestor. And at varying times through my research, I had each one of them, just one at a time, of course, as that ancestor. But in a year or two, I find that couldn't be, you see? So I had to drop them. Now, one day, I get a letter from a man, Wayne Witt Bates, from Fairfax, Virginia. Never heard of him in my life before. He said, "I understand you are searching the Harbors." He says, "I'm searching the Witts." Of course, the first Thomas Harbor married Sarah Witt. See what I mean? That was the first start of the Harbors here in this country. I thought you might be interested in this attached Xerox copy of a deed. It said, David Witt sells to David Harbor, comma, son of Elijah. I said, that's the answer to my prayer. I knew that this David married a Spurlock. See? So, I had a correspondent out in Kansas looking for the same David. So I quickly wrote her. Now, the reason that relationship was put in the deed was the way back then they told anybody interested that David Harbor was a minor. He was only 7 years old. Today, it would be to a guardian or to a trustee, you see. All right, now, this sale was probably in connection with David's father's death in the settlement of his estate, see, because he died young. And that, about 12 or 15 years later, this property was 313 acres of land on Goblingtown Creek in Patrick County, Virginia. Then, about 10 or 12, maybe 15 years later, David sold 313 acres of land on Goblingtown Creek in Patrick County, Virginia. And his wife, Mary, that's Mary Spurlock, see, waived her dower rights. That was the way then in fact, if a man was married, he couldn't sell a piece of land unless he had that assurance from, it was her way of saying that I agree to this, see what I mean? So, the only discrepancy was that my wife's meager records showed that David Harbor married Sarah Spurlock. But later records show that he married Mary Spurlock, daughter of Jesse Spurlock and Sarah Harbor.
Well, Lou, thank you again.
Okay, let me have that book. Oh, let me.